back in our Bibles this morning to the book of Jeremiah, the prophecies of Jeremiah. Jeremiah has always, that's a big term, isn't it? Someone says that's a little bit too long, but... It has been for a long time one of my favorite Old Testament books, if I can use that term.
Sure.
Brother Bruce and Dorothy and I have been talking a lot lately about this Old Testament and New Testament thing. Who started that? Who divided the Bible? But anyway, we usually know what we're saying, or everybody knows what we're saying when we use those terms. But it has been a favorite of mine, and I believe it is very pertinent to our particular day, because the principles that are established by Jeremiah in these prophecies certainly apply to us today, and the failures that we see of the people of Israel to live up to and according to those principles, we're seeing exactly the same thing today in our own society, in our nation, but we're seeing it all over the world. As Brother Dale noted earlier, it's not just the United States, it's not just our country, but it's all over the world to a very, very large degree. So anyway, I think it has been good for us, and I trust that it has. And one of my main objectives has been for some time to try to prepare my own heart and the hearts of you, yourselves, to this day that we live in. And we're going to have to cope with it. We're going to have to deal with it. We're going to have to live in this day because this is our time. Now, there is much to be concerned about, not worried about, but we need to be concerned about it. There's much to be concerned about. There's much to deplore about what's going on in this nation and in the world today. But dearly beloved, I need to focus more upon those things that are good. It's hard to do when you're reading and studying in a book like Jeremiah. And yet, that's the whole purpose, isn't it? That God is sending judgment against Judah and the nations is because He is directing His people to that which is good. I've forgotten exactly which chapter it's in. I could find it pretty quick if I look, but there is one place, you see, where God says that He's sending the people of Judah into this captivity for their good. Maybe that's hard for us to understand, but God is bringing you and me into this period of our life for our good. For our good. Well, we're down through chapter 45 of Jeremiah. Now, chapters 46 through 51 of this book is more or less a commentary on the 25th chapter of Jeremiah. He is going to go over again the judgment of God that is pronounced against the nations. Now, he's not going to name every one of them in these last books of his prophecy, but he is going to use a representative number of these nations to illustrate again his displeasure and to show forth the judgment that he is bringing forth. Now, we're not going to try to go verse by verse in these next few chapters of this book. We're going to try to just take some things, thoughts from them, and show again the judgment of God and the reason for that judgment. Now, if we take to heart what God says concerning the judgment and why He's bringing judgment upon these nations, then it will cause us to examine our own selves, our own church, our own churches, as it were, our sister churches, and turn from those things that are opposed to God and turn back to those things which are extremely godly. Brother Dale took us then to the psalm not too terribly long ago that admonishes us to do what? To turn, right? Turn, turn. And we find that over and over again in the books of the Bible. Well, again, going back to chapter 25 of Jeremiah, we're going to look at that very, very briefly just to restore our minds on this. In verse 15 of Jeremiah chapter 25, he says, "For thus saith the Lord God of Israel unto me, take the wine cup of this fury at my hand, and cause all the nations to whom I send thee to drink it. And they shall drink and be moved and be mad because of the sword that I will send among them." So Jeremiah says, "I took the cup at the Lord's hand and made all the nations to drink unto whom the Lord had sent me." And then he begins to name them off, and he begins at Jerusalem, and he goes down through all of these nations in the known world at that time. And then in verse 26, he says, or 25, he says, "And all the kings of Zimri, and all the kings of Elam, and all the kings of the Medes, and all the kings of the north, far and near, one with another, and all the kingdoms of the world, which are upon the face of the earth, and the king of Shishak shall drink after them. Therefore thou shalt say unto them, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, Drink ye, and be drunken, and spew, and fall, and rise no more, because of the sword which I will send among you. And it shall be, if they refuse to take the cup at thine hand to drink, then shalt thou say unto them, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, ye shall certainly drink. For lo, I began to bring evil on the city which is called by my name, and should ye be utterly unpunished, ye shall not be unpunished, for I will call for a sword upon all the inhabitants of the earth, saith the Lord of hosts." Now, one of the reasons that I say that chapters 46 through 51 are a commentary on these verses here in the 25th chapter of Jeremiah is because of what Jeremiah says in chapter 49 let me get to chapter 49 in verse 12. He says, "For thus saith the Lord, Behold, they whose judgment was not to drink of the cup have assuredly drunken. And art thou he that shall altogether go unpunished? Thou shalt not go unpunished, but thou shalt surely drink of it." Now, this is a clear reference, as far as I can tell, back to chapter 25. Now, we're also going to see in a few moments, in chapter 46, we're going to see verses 27 and 28 are almost verbatim the same words that Jeremiah uses in chapter 30, verses 15 and 16. So Jeremiah is going to give a commentary upon what he's already said and what he has capitalized, if you will, in chapter 25. And so here's what we're looking at. In chapter 46, then, it begins with the word of the Lord. That's always very prominent, isn't it? And it's always very important. In fact, it is absolutely necessary that we understand it's the word of the Lord. The word of the Lord which came to Jeremiah the prophet against the Gentiles, against Egypt, against the army of Pharaoh Necho, king of Egypt, which was by the river Euphrates in Carchemish, which Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, smote in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah. And here's what the prophecy is. Order ye the buckler and shield, and draw near to battle. Harness the horses, and get up, ye horsemen, and stand forth with your helmets. Furbish the spears, and put on the brigandines. Therefore, wherefore have I seen them dismayed and turned away back, and their mighty ones are beaten down and are fled apace, and look not back, for fear was round about, saith the Lord. Let not the swift flee away, nor the mighty man escape. They shall stumble and fall toward the north by the river Euphrates. Now, we could go on and read this entire thing, but I don't think it's really necessary, because once again, what Jeremiah is doing, he is outlining, he's going through, well, I say outlining, he's really stating in unequivocal terms, in great detail, he's stating what God is going to do when it comes to Egypt. He is going to destroy, Egypt. He's going to bring the mighty power of Egypt down to nothing. Now, all of these promises of God concerning these great nations ought to give us hope. It was meant to give the Israelites hope, because God knew what the Israelites were facing. Even if they didn't understand it, God did. And God was sending them a message. If they didn't understand it right now, they would understand it when this all came about. Now, oftentimes it's hard for us to really believe what God says, isn't it? Because it seems so improbable and impossible as far as man is concerned. And yet, everything that God says comes to pass exactly as He says it. No matter how difficult it may seem to us, it's nothing to God. I still go back to the time we were in the Philippines, and Brother I had his name on there. Anyway, one of the brethren was preaching there, and he said something about something being a problem to God, and another one jumped up, and he says, "No, it's no problem to God." And it brought on a big discussion, and which was good, and but he was right. Nothing is a problem to God. He knows it from before it ever happens, doesn't he? And he knows the outcome of it. But here's the thing. Here's one of the amazing things to think about Egypt. And it's always, Egypt has, in the Bible, has always implied it's been a type of sin. Always. But here's an interesting thing. Here's one of the interesting things that I wanted to bring out. In verse 26 of this chapter, it says, "And I will deliver them into the hand of those that seek their lives." This is talking about Egypt now. "And into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and into the hand of his servants." Now there's a colon there. And then there's this that's added. It says, "And afterward it shall be inhabited as in the days of old, saith the Lord." Isn't that strange? He's talking about Egypt. Now, Ezekiel testifies that it's going to last 40 years, and then God is going to restore Egypt to a degree. There's going to be 40 years that Egypt is going to be what the Bible terms a desolation. But after 40 years, and why 40 years? Well, who knows? But after 40 years, then God is going to restore Egypt, at least to a degree. But it, more important than that, Isaiah has something to say about Egypt. If you look back in Isaiah, in chapter 11, first, in verse 15, it says, "And the Lord shall utterly destroy the tongue of the Egyptian sea, and with his mighty wind shall he shake his hand over the river, and shall smite it in the seven streams, and make men go over dry shod. And there shall be an highway for the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria, like as it was to Israel in the day that he came up out of the land of Egypt." Now, we've got the Assyrians mentioned here, and Israel and Egypt all bound together there. But if you look in chapter 19 of Isaiah, in verse 23, Isaiah says, "In that day there shall be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria, and the Egyptian shall serve with the Assyrians. In that day shall Israel be the third with Egypt and with Assyria, even a blessing in the midst of the land. When the Lord of hosts shall bless, saying, Blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, mine inheritance." Now, you ask me, well, what all does that mean? Well, I'm not sure what all it means, except that what it says. That's all I know how to what to say against one of those things that, as far as, you know, my mind is concerned, I think, well, how is that going to come to pass? But with God, it's not impossible. And to what degree, and you know, the details of what is going to happen, I don't know. I just have to admit it. I don't know. And yet, in the last two Bible conferences that we've been at over at Conyers, Georgia, Brother David Dickerson has related something of the work that they're doing in Egypt. And he didn't do it this past June, but last year, I say year, between Christmas and New Year's, he was talking about the fact that he went to Egypt. The first time he went to Egypt, to meet with the brethren over there. He said they were going into this building, and the man told him, he said, look, just when it gets through, when the meeting is over, he said, we'll go out the back way and come around. And Brother David said he wondered, well, why are we going to go out the back way? Why don't we just go out the front? But he said it didn't take him long to understand, because he said there's three tiers to that building. And he said there were approximately 400 people in each one of those tiers. That's 1,200 people in Egypt that were sitting listening to the gospel being preached. Now, this past time, I've forgotten exactly, I believe he said there's 46 Baptist churches in Egypt, and then besides that, there's 17 mission stations in Egypt right now. I would.
There's a Baptist seminary.
Yeah, there's a Baptist seminary there. So what is God doing? Is this part of the fulfillment of that prophecy of Isaiah? It would sure appear to be so. And what do? We rejoice in it. We rejoice in it. God is still calling out His people wherever they are. He knows where they are. He knows them by name. And He is calling them out by the preaching of the gospel. And even in the darkest areas of this world, where you would think that the gospel would have the most difficult time, it's producing its greatest results. What about North Korea? What about Iraq? As the Apostle Paul said when he was in that jail, we may be bound, and I'm paraphrasing this, that we may be bound, but the gospel is not bound. So in the midst of all of this judgment, you see, there is a bright and a shining light. And His name is Jesus. And His people are coming to that light because their deeds are wrought in God. So as we look at this, chapter 47, it begins, "The word of the Lord that came to Jeremiah the prophet against the Philistines." Now, chapter 47 is going to go into, once again, much of the detail of how God is going to destroy, if you will, the Philistines. Chapter 48 begins, it says, "Against Moab, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, woe unto Nebo, for it is spoiled. Kiriathaim is confounded and taken. Mishgab is confounded and dismayed. There shall be no more praise of Moab. In Heshbon they have devised evil against it. Come and let us cut it off from being a nation. Also thou shalt be cut down, O madman. The sword shall pursue thee. A voice of crying shall be from Horonaim, spoiling and great destruction. Moab is destroyed. Her little ones have caused a cry to be heard. For in the going up of Luhith continual weeping shall go up, for in the going down of Horonaim, the enemies have heard a cry of destruction. So, if we didn't read any further than that, I mean, it seems pretty obvious and pretty absolute that God is going to do a great work of judgment against Moab. Now, who is Moab? What's the origin of Moab? Well, goes all the way back to Lot, doesn't it? The eldest daughter of Lot, Moab, was the son that was born to the eldest daughter of Lot through that incestuous union. When the two daughters that escaped from Sodom and Gomorrah with Lot, now they're in this mountain cave. They're living in a cave. And these two daughters get their father drunk, and children are conceived by them laying with their father. And one of them was Moab, the eldest son, daughter's child, and Ben-Ammi is the other one, the youngest daughter's. Now, Moab is the one that we're talking about here. When we get down to chapter 49, then we encounter the Ammonites, which were the descendants of Ben-Ammi. So, both of these daughters, their children are playing into this judgment of God. So Moab, and why was Moab so much in the eye of God? Ruth. Sir? Ruth is one of them, right? Isn't that amazing? Though, again, that here is a nation that's under the judgment of God. Always has been. From the very beginning, it's under the judgment of God. But there, here's Ruth that becomes the mother of one of the descendants of Jesus.
David's grandfather.
Yeah. Yeah. Obed, and then Jesse, and then David. God does according to His own will. In the heavens above, in the earth beneath, and in all the deep places. Isn't that wonderful? What can He do today? It's not only what He can do, but what He will do. Now, is He bringing judgment upon this world? Yes, He is absolutely bringing judgment upon this world. But again, may I remind you that everywhere in the Bible that you find God bringing judgment, you will also find Him bringing salvation to His people. It all goes all the way over to Peter, doesn't it? Judgment must begin at the house of the Lord. We see that in the 9th chapter of Ezekiel. That's where it begins. But what is it for? It is to do away with the chaff and to separate the grain. So it's what we're doing. Look in verse 26 of chapter 48. Make ye him drunk, talking about Moab, for he magnified himself against the Lord. Moab also shall wallow in his vomit, and he also shall be in derision. For was not Israel a derision unto thee? Was he found among the thieves? For since thou speakest of him, thou skippest for joy. One of the reasons that God is destroying Moab, the judgment is falling on Moab, is because of the way that they treated Israel, especially when they were coming up out of Egypt, and Moab, along with Ammonites, would not allow them to come through their country. And help them. In other words, they still, and this is one of the things that's going on over there right now in the Middle East. These people from the time of Esau have hated God's people. They still bear a grudge against God's people. Now, God is bringing judgment. He has pronounced the judgment against Moab. And, of course, for the most part, it's already been carried out. History teaches us that. Same thing with the Ammonites, chapter 49. Concerning the Ammonites, thus saith the Lord, hath Israel no sons? Hath he no heir? Why then doth their king inherit Gad, and his people dwell in his cities? Therefore, behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will cause an alarm of war to be heard in Rabbah of the Ammonites, and it shall be a desolate heap, and her daughters shall be burned with fire. Then shall Israel be heir unto them that were his heirs, saith the Lord. Howl, O Heshbon, for Ai is full. Cry, ye daughters of Rabbah. Gird you with sackcloth. Lament and run to and fro by the hedges, for their king shall go into captivity, and his priest and his princes together. Wherefore gloriest thou in the valleys that thy flowing valley, O backsliding daughter, that trusteth in her treasure, saying, Who shall come unto me? Behold, I will bring a fear upon thee, saith the Lord God of hosts, from all those that be about thee, and ye shall be driven out every man right forth, and none shall gather up him that wandereth. And afterward I will bring again the captivity of the children of Ammon, saith the Lord. What a message. He turneth men to destruction, and then he turns around and saith, Return, ye children of men. Now God is going to, He is judging, He is going to judge this world, and there's going to be extreme amounts of destruction that is coming. But in it all, he's still going to find his people. And he is taking a people from where? Yeah, every tribe, every kindred, every tongue, every nation, God is going to, he has a people there. And we can rejoice in that. Now, verse 7, he changes from Ammon to Edom. Now, who is Edom?
Esau.
Yeah. It's Esau, the one that God
hates.
Now, Edom is another one And as actually, especially, Edom, and I may have confused that a little bit a while ago between Moab and Ammon. But Esau is the one. The descendants of Esau they've always hated the people of Israel. And they've always hated, as it were, God's people. There's a type there. Edom is of the world, and God's people are not of the world. But Edom, Esau, here is addressed. Concerning Edom, thus saith the Lord of hosts, is wisdom no more in Teman? Is counsel perished from the prudent? Is their wisdom vanished? Flee ye, turn back, dwell deep, O inhabitants of Dedan, for I will bring the calamity of Esau upon him the time that I will visit him. If grape gatherers come to thee, would they not leave some gleaning grapes? Now he's going to again give us an idea of the thoroughness with which God is going to deal with Esau or Edom, the people of Esau. If thieves by night, they will destroy till they have enough. But I have made Esau bare. I have uncovered his secret places, and he shall not be able to hide himself. His seed is spoiled, and his brethren and his neighbors, and he is not. Now, again, we don't have time to do it, but you can, if you go over to the book of Obadiah, the prophecy of Obadiah gives you a detail of God's judgment against Edom and why. And it's simply because that they have hated, and both the Edomites and the Moabites and the Ammonites, when Nebuchadnezzar came against Israel, those three fought with Nebuchadnezzar against Israel. They helped them. And for this, God's judgment is sure and it is quick. Now again, in verse 12, for thus saith the Lord, behold, they whose judgment was not to drink of the cup have assuredly drunken. Going back again to chapter 25. And art thou he that shall altogether go unpunished? Thou shalt not go unpunished, but thou shalt surely drink of it. Now, if you study your history, you find out that the nation of Edom, the Edomites, were the ones that dwelt in the mountains, and if there ever was a fortress, a natural fortress, it was where the capital of the Edomites was. There was a very, very narrow passage between the mountains that led back into to Petra. And they thought that it was absolutely impregnable. But with God, that's not so, is it? There's nothing that's going to save you from God except God Himself. So, we have these judgments of God. In verse 23, it's concerning Damascus. In verse 28, it's concerning Kedar. And then we get down to verse 34, and it's concerning Elam. And then if we get into chapters 50 and 51, both of these chapters deal with the Chaldeans. Now, when we get into chapter 50 and 51, it's going to lead us a lot closer to home. And you say, well, why do you say that? Because when we're talking about Babylon, we naturally are led into mystery, Babylon. which is covered to, for us in the 17th and the 18th chapters of the book of the Revelation. Now, we're not going to be able to get into that today, but need to pray about this. It's very important to the church today to understand this mystery Babylon. It has a very prominent place in the Revelation. In fact, there are two whole chapters in the Revelation that are devoted to this mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, and the abomination of the whole earth. Sounds pretty important, doesn't it? Well, it does to me. But this morning, I want us to close or come to the conclusion of this message by turning back to chapter 46. And I want us to look briefly at verses 27 and 28. Now again, this is at the end of Jeremiah's prophecy against Egypt, and then very briefly, just a word or two, but it's also for Egypt. You know, God doesn't leave us in the dark about anything that's necessary. But in verse 27, he says, "But fear not thou, O my servant Jacob." So in the midst of all of this judgment, including, you understand, Jerusalem. Go back to chapter 25 again in verse 15 and 16. Where does God's judgment begin? It begins with the house of the Lord. It begins with Jerusalem. But now he says, "But fear not thou, O my servant Jacob, and be not dismayed, O Israel. For behold, I will save thee from afar off, and thy seed from the land of their captivity. And Jacob shall return and be in rest and at peace, and none shall make him afraid." That ought to be a little bit encouraging, shouldn't it? There is coming a time when God is going to cleanse this earth. He's going to cleanse the world of all sin, of all unrighteousness. There's nothing going to be left in it that makes a lie. What a day that will be. It's described for us, especially to some degree, in the 11th chapter of Isaiah, but more specifically in chapter 65 of Isaiah. But in verse 28, he says, "Fear thou not, O Jacob my servant, saith the Lord, for I am with thee, for I will make a full end of all nations." Now this is one of the things I want to point out here. That's pretty inclusive language there, isn't it? Is he going to do that? Has he done it already? No, we've still got a lot of nations around, haven't we? But you see, there's only one nation of God. There's only one church of God. There's only one sheepfold of God. And there's only one shepherd, one priest, one Lord, one King. There's only one God. So when he says here that he is going to make a full end of all the nations whither I have driven thee, I have to take that at face value. He's going to make a full end of everything but spiritual Israel. And he says, but I will not make a full end of thee. As we look at these things, one of the things that I've referenced here is the 24th chapter of Matthew and verse 14 in that chapter. And it simply talks about the end of this world. Now, some people may have a problem with that, but I don't see how it can be any other thing. But in verse 14, he says, "And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations." And then what is going to happen? The end. Then shall the end come. Well, there is no other explanation. It's very clearly implied that when the gospel has had its course through all the world, when God has brought forth His people from all the world, out of all the world, then the end, which is the same, well, I say the same, it's the same principle, but it's the opposite pole of what we've been studying in the afternoons. And what is that? The beginning. And we've said if there's a beginning, there's always got to be an end, and if there's an end, there had to be a beginning. So when the gospel has been preached for a witness to all nations, then shall the end come. Now, once again, it won't come before that, but it will not delay, not one bit. It will come. And I believe that's the time that he's going to make a full end of all these nations. Won't have any use for them any longer, will he? They will have served his purpose. Now, the other scripture, one other scripture at least, that I'm referring to here is over in Romans chapter 11. And actually, there's two scriptures in this chapter that are maybe more than that. But first of all, in verse 14, Paul says, "If by any means I may provoke to emulation them which are my flesh, and might save," and what's the next word? "Some of them." Now, the apostle has already said in verse 1, "I say then, hath God cast away his people?" It would seem like that God has cast away his people. But he says, "God forbid, for I also am an Israelite of the seed of Abraham, the tribe of Benjamin. God hath not cast away his people." And then what's the next three words? "Which he foreknew." Now, the reason I'm bringing this out again is because that many people today believe that verse 26, of chapter 11 teaches that all of the Israelites are going to finally be saved. And I'm saying that that's not what that is teaching. It is teaching that all Israel that are truly God's people will be saved. God hath not cast away His people whom He foreknew. In other words, the elect, He's not going to cast them away, never will cast them away. And that is the promise that God is making, and that's who He's speaking to in chapter 46 of Isaiah, and again chapter 30. But when He says, "Fear not, thou, O my servant Jacob." The message of God is going to save some of them. In verse 26 then, "And so all Israel shall be saved, as it is written, there shall come out of Zion the Deliverer, and shall turn ungodliness from" who?
Jacob.
"From Jacob. For this is my covenant unto them, when I shall take away their sins." Now, we do believe, again, that God is going to save many of the descendants of Abraham in these last days. Verse 25 of chapter 11, "For I would not, brethren, that ye should be ignorant of this mystery, lest ye should be wise in your own conceits, that blindness in part is happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in." So we do believe that God is going to save many of His people. How many? We don't know. All the elect. All that He foreknew, they are going to be saved. But He's going to make a full end of the nations. And finally, what's going to be left? Only those that God has foreknown from the very foundation of the world. But in all of the judgment of God, that judgment of God is to satisfy His holiness and to satisfy His justice, and to bring in everlasting salvation for His people. Judgment is come and is coming upon this world, and we may as well accept it and find a joy in it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Peace, righteousness, and joy.
Some people have a joy, of course, in thinking that they're going to get through all of this and it's not going to affect them. But our joy is to be found in the place that God is in this judgment going to vindicate His righteousness, and He's going to make a way, bring in everlasting salvation. So let us rejoice in that.